greatest moment in his life. In Berlin, Einstein put on an appearance of nonchalance, but he could not completely hide his eagerness as he awaited word. The downward spiral of the German economy in 1919 meant that the elevator in his apartment building had been shut down, and he was preparing for a winter with little heat. "Much shivering lies ahead for the winter," he wrote his ailing mother on September 5th. "There is still no news about the eclipse." In a letter a week later to his friend Paul Ehrenfest in Holland, Einstein ended with an affected casual question. "Have you by any chance heard anything over there about the English solar eclipse observation?" Just by asking the question, Einstein showed he was not quite as sanguine as he tried to appear, because his friends in Holland would certainly have already sent him such news if they had it. Finally, they did. On September 22, 1919, Lawrence sent a cable based on what he had just heard from a fellow astronomer who had talked to Eddington at a meeting. Eddington found stellar shift at solar limb, tentative value between 0.9 seconds and twice that. It was wonderfully ambiguous. Was it a shift of 0.85 arc second, as Newton's emission theory and Einstein's discarded 1912 theory would have it, or twice that, as he now predicted? Einstein had no doubts. "Today, some happy news," he wrote his mother. "Lawrence telegraphed me that the British expeditions have verified the deflection of light by the sun." Perhaps his confidence was partly an attempt to cheer up his mother, who was suffering from stomach cancer. But it is more likely that it was because he knew his theory was correct. Einstein was with a graduate student, Ilse Schneider, shortly after Lawrence's news arrived. "He suddenly interrupted the discussion," she later recalled, "and reached for the telegram that was lying on a windowsill. 'Perhaps this will interest you,' he said, handing it to her. Naturally, she was overjoyed and excited, but Einstein was quite calm. 'I knew the theory was correct,' he told her. But she asked, 'What if the experiments had shown his theory to be wrong?' He replied, 'Then I would have been sorry for the dear Lord. The theory is correct.'" As more precise news of the eclipse results spread, Max Planck was among those who gently noted to Einstein that it was good to have his own confidence confirmed by some actual facts. "You have already said many times that you never personally doubted what the result would be," Planck wrote, "but it is beneficial nonetheless if now this fact is indubitably established for others as well." For Einstein's stolid patron, the triumph had a transcendent aspect. "The intimate union between the beautiful, the true, and the real has again been proved." Einstein replied to Planck with a veneer of humility, "It is a gift from gracious destiny that I have been allowed to experience this." Einstein's celebratory exchange with his closer friends in Zurich was more lighthearted. The physics colloquium there sent him a piece of doggerel. "All doubts have now been spent. At last it has been found. Light is naturally bent to Einstein's great renown." To which Einstein replied a few days later, referring to the eclipse, "Light and heat Mrs. Sun us tenders, yet loves not he who broods and ponders. So she contrives many a year how she may hold her secret dear. Now came the lunar visitor kind, for joy she almost forgot to shine. Her deepest secrets, too, she lost. Eddington, you know, has snapped a shot." In defense of Einstein's poetic prowess, it should be noted that his verse works better in German, in which the last two lines end with gekommen and aufgenommen. The first unofficial announcement came at a meeting of the Dutch Royal Academy. Einstein sat proudly on stage as Lawrence described Eddington's findings to an audience of close to 1,000 cheering students and scholars. But it was a closed meeting with no press, so the leaks about the results merely added to the great public anticipation leading up to the official announcement scheduled for 2 weeks later in London. The distinguished members of the Royal Society, Britain's most venerable scientific institution, met along with colleagues from the Royal Astronomical Society on the afternoon of November 6, 1919, at Burlington House in Piccadilly, for what they knew was likely to be a historic event. There was only one item on the agenda, the report on the eclipse observations. Sir J. J. Thompson, the Royal Society's president and discoverer of the electron, was in the chair. Alfred North Whitehead, the philosopher, had come down from Cambridge and was in the audience taking notes. Gazing down on them from an imposing portrait in the Great Hall was Isaac Newton. The whole atmosphere of tense interest was exactly that of the Greek drama, Whitehead recorded. We were the chorus, commenting on the decree of destiny, and in the background the picture of Newton to remind us that the greatest of scientific generalizations was, now, after more than two centuries, to receive its first modification. The Astronomer Royal, Sir Frank Dyson, had the honor of presenting the findings. He described in detail the equipment, the photographs, and the complexities of the calculations. His conclusion, however, was simple. After a careful study of the plates, I am prepared to say that there can be no doubt that they confirm Einstein's prediction, he announced. The results of the expeditions to Sobral and Principe leave little doubt that a deflection of light takes place in the neighborhood of the sun, and that it is of the amount demanded by Einstein's generalized theory of relativity. There was some skepticism in the room. We owe it to that great man to proceed very carefully in modifying or retouching his law of gravitation, cautioned Ludwig Silberstein, gesturing at Newton's portrait. But it was the commanding giant J. J. Thompson who set the tone. The result is one of the greatest achievements of human thought, he declared. Einstein was back in Berlin, so he missed the excitement. He celebrated by buying a new violin, but he understood the historic impact of the announcement that the laws of Sir Isaac Newton no longer fully governed all aspects of the universe. Newton, forgive me, Einstein later wrote, noting the moment. You found the only way which, in your age, was just about possible for a man of highest thought and creative power. It was a grand triumph, but not one easily understood. The skeptical Silberstein came up to Eddington and said that people believed that only three scientists in the world understood general relativity. He had been told that Eddington was one of them. The shy Quaker said nothing. Don't be so modest, Eddington, said Silberstein. Replied Eddington, on the contrary, I'm just wondering who the third might be. Chapter 12. Fame. 1919. Lights all askew. Einstein's theory of relativity burst into the consciousness of a world that was weary of war and yearning for a triumph of human transcendence. Almost a year to the day after the end of the brutal fighting, here was an announcement that the theory of a German Jew had been proven correct by an English Quaker. Scientists belonging to two warring nations had collaborated again, exulted the physicist Leopold Infeld. It seemed the beginning of a new era. The Times of London carried stories on November 7th about the defeated Germans being summoned to Paris to face treaty demands from the British and French, but it also carried the following triple-decked headline. Revolution in Science. New Theory of the Universe. Newtonian Ideas Overthrown. The scientific concept of the fabric of the universe must be changed, the paper proclaimed. Einstein's newly confirmed theory will require a new philosophy of the universe, a philosophy that will sweep away nearly all that has hitherto been accepted. The New York Times caught up with the story 2 days later. Not having a science correspondent in London, the paper assigned the story to its golf expert, Henry Crouch, who at first decided to skip the Royal Society announcement, then changed his mind, but then couldn't get in. So he telephoned Eddington to get a summary, and, somewhat baffled, asked him to repeat it in simpler words. Perhaps due to Eddington's enthusiasm in the retelling, or due to Crouch's enthusiasm in the reporting, Eddington's appraisal of Einstein's theory was enhanced to read, one of the greatest, perhaps the greatest, of achievements in the history of human thought. But given the frenzy about to ensue, the headline was rather restrained. Eclipse showed gravity variation. Diversion of light rays accepted as affecting Newton's principles. Hailed as epoch-making. British scientist calls the discovery one of the greatest of human achievements. The following day, the New York Times apparently decided that it had been too restrained. So it followed up with an even more excited story, its six-deck headline a classic from the days when newspapers knew how to write classic headlines. Lights all askew in the heavens. Men of science more or less agog over results of eclipse observations. Einstein theory triumphs. Stars not where they seemed or were calculated to be, but nobody need worry. A book for 12 wise men. No more in all the world could comprehend it, said Einstein, when his daring publishers accepted it. For days, the New York Times, with a bygone touch of merry populism, played up the complexity of the theory as an affront to common sense. This news is distinctly shocking, and apprehensions for confidence even in the multiplication table will arise, it editorialized on November 11th. The idea that space has limits was most assuredly silly, the paper decided. It just doesn't, by definition, and that's the end of it, for common folk, however it may be for higher mathematicians. It returned to the theme 5 days later. Scientists who proclaim that space comes to an end somewhere are under some obligation to tell us what lies beyond it. Finally, a week after its first story, the paper decided that some words of calm, more amused than bemused, might be useful. British scientists seem to have been seized with something like an intellectual panic when they heard a photographic verification of Einstein's theory, the paper pointed out. But they are slowly recovering as they realize that the sun still rises, apparently, in the east, and will continue to do so for some time to come. An intrepid correspondent for the newspaper in Berlin was able to get an interview with Einstein in his apartment on December 2nd, and in the process launched one of the apocryphal tales about relativity. After describing Einstein's top-floor study, the reporter asserted, "It was from this lofty library that he observed years ago a man dropping from a neighboring roof, luckily on a pile of soft rubbish, and escaping almost without injury. The man told Dr. Einstein that in falling, he experienced no sensation commonly considered as the effect of gravity." That was how, the article said, Einstein developed a sublimation or supplement of Newton's law of gravity. As one of the stacked headlines of the article put it, "Inspired as Newton was, but by the fall of a man from a roof instead of the fall of an apple." This was, in fact, as the newspaper would say, a pile of soft rubbish. Einstein had done his thought experiment while working in the Bern Patent Office in 1907, not in Berlin, and it had not involved a person actually falling. "The newspaper drivel about me is pathetic," he wrote Zanger when the article came out. But he understood and accepted how journalism worked. This kind of exaggeration meets a certain need among the public. There was, indeed, an astonishing public craving to understand relativity. Why? The theory seemed somewhat incomprehensible, yes, but also very enticing in its mystery. Warped space? The bending of light rays? Time and space not absolute? The theory had the wondrous mix of, huh? And wow, that can capture the public imagination. This was lampooned in a Ray Irvin cartoon in The New Yorker, which showed a baffled janitor, fur-clad matron, doorman, kids, and others scratching their heads with wild surmise as they wandered down the street. The caption was a quote from Einstein. "People slowly accustomed themselves to the idea that the physical states of space itself were the final physical reality." As Einstein put it to Grossman, "Now every coachman and waiter argues about whether or not relativity theory is correct." Einstein's friends found themselves besieged whenever they lectured on it. Leopold Infeld, who later worked with Einstein, was then a young schoolteacher in a small Polish town. "At the time I did what hundreds of others did all over the world," he recalled. "I gave a public lecture on the theory of relativity. And the crowd that lined up on a cold winter night was so great that it could not be accommodated in the largest hall in town." The same thing happened to Eddington when he spoke at Trinity College, Cambridge. Hundreds jammed the hall, and hundreds more were turned away. In his attempt to make the subject comprehensible, Eddington said that if he was traveling near the speed of light, he would be only 3 feet tall. That made the newspaper headlines. Lawrence likewise gave a speech to an overflow audience. He compared the Earth to a moving vehicle as a way to illustrate some examples of relativity. Soon, many of the greatest physicists and thinkers began writing their own books explaining the theory, including Eddington, von Laue, Freundlich, Lorentz, Planck, Born, Pauli, and even the philosopher and mathematician Bertrand Russell. In all, more than 600 books and articles on relativity were published in the first 6 years after the eclipse observations. Einstein himself had the opportunity to explain it in his own words in the Times of London, which commissioned him to write an article called "What is the Theory of Relativity?" The result was actually quite comprehensible. His own popular book on the subject, Relativity, the Special and General Theory, had first appeared in German in 1916. Now, in the wake of the eclipse observation, Einstein published it in English as well. Filled with many thought experiments that could easily be visualized, it became a bestseller, with updated editions appearing over the ensuing years. The Publicity Paradox. Einstein had just the right ingredients to be transformed into a star. Reporters, knowing that the public was yearning for a refreshing international celebrity, were thrilled that the newly discovered genius was not a drab or reserved academic. Instead, he was a charming 40-year-old, just passing from handsome to distinctive, with a wild burst of hair, rumpled informality, twinkling eyes, and a willingness to dispense wisdom in bite-sized quips and quotes. His friend, Paul Ehrenfest, found the press attention rather ridiculous. "The startled newspaper ducks flutter up in a hefty bout of quacking," he joked. To Einstein's sister Maya, who grew up at a time before people actually liked publicity, the attention was astonishing, and she assumed that he found it completely distasteful. "An article was published about you in a Lucerne paper," she marveled, not fully appreciating that he had made the front pages around the world. "I imagine this causes you much unpleasantness, that so much is being written about you." Einstein indeed bemoaned his newfound fame, repeatedly. "He was being hounded by the press and other riffraff," he complained to Max Born. "It's so dreadful that I can barely breathe anymore, not to mention getting around to any sensible work." To another friend, he painted an even more vivid picture of the perils of publicity. "Since the flood of newspaper articles, I've been so deluged with questions, invitations, and requests that I dream I'm burning in hell, and the postman is the devil, eternally roaring at me, hurling new bundles of letters at my head, because I have not yet answered the old ones." Einstein's aversion to publicity, however, existed a bit more in theory than in reality. It would have been possible, indeed easy, for him to have shunned all interviews, pronouncements, pictures, and public appearances. Those who truly dislike the public spotlight do not turn up, as the Einsteins eventually would, with Charlie Chaplin on a red carpet at one of his movie premieres. There was a streak in him that enjoyed the photographers in the crowds, the essayist C.P. Snow said, after getting to know him. He had an element of the exhibitionist and the ham. If there had not been that element, there would have been no photographers and no crowds. Nothing is easier than to avoid publicity. If one genuinely doesn't want it, one doesn't get it. Einstein's response to adulation was as complex as that of the cosmos to gravity. He was attracted and repelled by the cameras, loved publicity, and loved to complain about it. His love-hate relationship with fame and reporters might seem unusual until one reflects on how similar it was to the mix of enjoyment, amusement, aversion, and annoyance that so many other famous people have felt. One reason that Einstein, unlike Planck or Lorentz or Bohr, became such an icon was because he looked the part, and because he could and would play the role. Scientists who become icons must not only be geniuses, but also performers, playing to the crowd and enjoying public acclaim, the physicist Freeman Dyson, no relation to the astronomer royal, has noted. Einstein performed. He gave interviews readily, peppered them with delightful aphorisms, and knew exactly what made for a good story. Even Elsa, or perhaps especially Elsa, enjoyed the attention. She served as her husband's protector, fearsome in her bark and withering in her nearsighted gaze when unwanted intruders barged into his orbit. but even more than her husband, she reveled in the stature and deference that came with fame. She began charging a fee to photograph him, and she donated the money to charities that fed hungry children in Vienna and elsewhere. In the current celebrity-soaked age, it is hard to recall the extent to which a century ago proper people recoiled from publicity and disdained those who garnered it. Especially in the realm of science, focusing on the personal seemed discordant. When Einstein's friend Max Born published a book on relativity right after the eclipse observations, he included, in his first edition, a frontispiece picture of Einstein and a short biography of him. Max von Laue and other friends of both men were appalled. Such things did not belong in a scientific book, even a popular one, von Laue wrote Born. Chastened, Born left these elements out of the next edition. As a result, Born was dismayed when it was announced in 1920 that Einstein had cooperated on a forthcoming biography by a Jewish journalist, Alexander Moskowski, who had mainly written humor and occult books. The book advertised itself in the title as being based on conversations with Einstein, and in fact it was. During the war, the gregarious Moskowski had befriended Einstein, been solicitous of his needs, and brought him into a semi-literary circle that hung around at a Berlin café. Born was a non-practicing Jew eager to assimilate into a German society, and he feared that the book would stoke a simmering anti-Semitism. Einstein's theories had been stamped as Jewish physics by colleagues, Born recalled, referring to the growing number of German nationalists who had begun decrying the abstract nature and supposed moral relativism inherent in Einstein's theories. And now a Jewish author, who had already published several books with frivolous titles, came along and wanted to write a similar book on Einstein. So Born and his wife, Hedwig, who never shied from berating Einstein, launched a crusade with their friends to stop its publication. "You must withdraw permission," Hedwig hectored, "at once, and by registered letter." She warned him that the gutter press would use it to tarnish his image and portray him as a self-promoting Jew. A completely new and far worse wave of persecution will be unleashed. The sin, she emphasized, was not what he said, but the fact that he was permitting any publicity for himself. "If I did not know you well, I would certainly not concede innocent motives under these circumstances. I would put it down to vanity. This book will constitute your moral death sentence for all but 4 or 5 of your friends. It could subsequently be the best confirmation of the accusation of self-advertisement." Her husband weighed in a week later with a warning that all of Einstein's anti-Semitic antagonists will triumph if he did not block publication. "Your Jewish friends, i.e. Moskowski, will have achieved what a pack of anti-Semites have failed to do." If Moskowski refused to back off, Born advised Einstein to get a restraining order from the public prosecutor's office. "Make sure this is reported in the newspapers," he said. "I shall send you the details of where to apply." Like many of their friends, Born worried that Elsa was the one who was more susceptible to the lures of publicity. As he told Einstein, "In these matters, you are a little child. We all love you, and you must obey judicious people, not your wife." Einstein took the advice of his friends, up to a point, by sending Moskowski a registered letter demanding that his splendid work not appear in print. But when Moskowski refused to back down, Einstein did not invoke legal measures. Both Ehrenfest and Lawrence agreed that going to court would serve only to inflame the issue and make matters worse. But Born disagreed. "You can flee to Holland," he said, referring to the ongoing effort by Ehrenfest and Lawrence to lure him there, "but his Jewish friends who remained in Germany would be affected by the stench." Einstein's detachment allowed him to affect an air of amusement rather than anxiety. "The whole affair is a matter of indifference to me, as is all the commotion and the opinion of each and every human being," he said. "I will live through all that is in store for me like an unconcerned spectator." When the book came out, it made Einstein an easier target for anti-Semites, who used it to bolster their contention that he was a self-promoter trying to turn his science into a business. But it did not cause much of a public commotion. There were, as Einstein noted to Born, no earth tremors. In retrospect, the controversy over publicity seems quaint and the book harmless fluff. I browsed through it a little and find it not quite as bad as I had expected, Bourne later admitted. It contains many rather amusing stories and anecdotes which are characteristic of Einstein. Einstein was able to resist letting his fame destroy his simple approach to life. On an overnight trip to Prague, he was afraid that dignitaries or curiosity seekers would want to celebrate him, so he decided to stay with his friend Philip Frank and his wife. The problem was that they actually lived in Frank's office suite at the physics laboratory, where Einstein had once worked himself. So Einstein slept on a sofa there. "This is probably not good enough for such a famous man," Frank recalled, "but it suited his liking for simple living habits and situations that contravened social conventions." Einstein insisted that, on the way back from a coffee house, they buy food for dinner so that Frank's wife need not go shopping. They chose some calf's liver, which Mrs. Frank proceeded to cook on the Bunsen burner in the office laboratory. Suddenly Einstein jumped up. "What are you doing?" he demanded. "Are you boiling the liver in water?" Mrs. Frank allowed that was indeed what she was doing. "The boiling point of water is too low," Einstein declared. "You must use a substance with a higher boiling point, such as butter or fat." From then on, Mrs. Frank referred to the necessity of frying liver as Einstein's theory. After Einstein's lecture that evening, there was a small reception given by the physics department at which several effusive speeches were made. When it was Einstein's turn to respond, he instead declared, "It will perhaps be pleasanter and more understandable if instead of making a speech, I play a piece for you on the violin." He proceeded to perform a sonata by Mozart, with, according to Frank, his simple, precise, and therefore doubly moving manner. The next morning, before he could depart, a young man tracked him down at Frank's office and insisted on showing him a manuscript. On the basis of his E equals mc squared equation, the man insisted it would be possible to use the energy contained within the atom for the production of frightening explosives. Einstein brushed away the discussion, calling the concept foolish. From Prague, Einstein took the train to Vienna, where 3,000 scientists and excited onlookers were waiting to hear him speak. At the station, his host waited for him to disembark from the first-class car, but didn't find him. He looked at the second-class car down the platform, and could not find him there either. Finally, strolling from the third-class car at the far end of the platform was Einstein, carrying his violin case like an itinerant musician. "You know, I like traveling first, but my face is becoming too well known," he told his host. "I'm less bothered in third class. With fame, I become more and more stupid, which, of course, is a very common phenomenon," Einstein told Sanger. But he soon developed a theory that his fame was, for all its annoyances, at least a welcome sign of the priority that society placed on people like himself. "The cult of individual personalities is always, in my view, unjustified. It strikes me as unfair, and even in bad taste, to select a few for boundless admiration, attributing superhuman powers of mind and character to them. This has been my fate, and the contrast between the popular estimate of my achievements and the reality is simply grotesque. This extraordinary state of affairs would be unbearable, but for one great consoling thought. It is a welcome symptom in an age which is commonly denounced as materialistic, that it makes heroes of men whose ambitions lie wholly in the intellectual and moral sphere." One problem with fame is that it can engender resentment. Especially in academic and scientific circles, self-promotion was regarded as a sin. There was a distaste for those who garnered personal publicity, a sentiment that may have been exacerbated by the fact that Einstein was a Jew. In the piece explaining relativity that he had written for the Times of London, Einstein humorously hinted at the issues that could arise. "By an application of the theory of relativity, today in Germany I am called a German man of science, and in England I am represented as a Swiss Jew," he wrote. "If I come to be regarded as a bête noire, the descriptions will be reversed, and I shall become a Swiss Jew for the Germans and a German man of science for the English." It was not entirely facetious. Just months after he became world-famous, the latter phenomenon occurred. He was told that he was to be given the prestigious gold medal of Britain's Royal Astronomical Society at the beginning of 1920, but a rebellion by a chauvinistic group of English purists forced the honor to be withheld. Far more ominously, a small but growing group in his native country soon began vocally portraying him as a Jew rather than as a German. Lone Traveler. Einstein liked to cast himself as a loner. Although he had an infectious laugh, like the barking of a seal, it could sometimes be wounding rather than warm. He loved being in a group, playing music, discussing ideas, drinking strong coffee, and smoking pungent cigars. Yet there was a faintly visible wall that separated him from even family and close friends. Starting with the Olympia Academy, he frequented many parlors of the mind, but he shied away from the inner chambers of the heart. He did not like to be constricted, and he could be cold to members of his family. Yet he loved the collegiality of intellectual companions, and he had friendships that lasted throughout his life. He was sweet toward people of all ages and classes who floated into his ken, got along well with staffers and colleagues, and tended to be genial toward humanity in general. As long as someone put no strong demands or emotional burdens on him, Einstein could readily forge friendships and even affections. This mix of coldness and warmth produced in Einstein a wry detachment as he floated through the human aspects of his world. "My passionate sense of social justice and social responsibility has always contrasted oddly with my pronounced lack of need for direct contact with other human beings and communities," he reflected. "I am truly a lone traveler, and have never belonged to my country, my home, my friends, or even my immediate family, with my whole heart. In the face of all these ties, I have never lost a sense of distance and a need for solitude." Even his scientific colleagues marveled at the disconnect between the genial smiles he bestowed on humanity in general and the detachment he displayed to the people close to him. "I do not know anyone as lonely and detached as Einstein," said his collaborator, Leopold Infeld. "His heart never bleeds, and he moves through life with mild enjoyment and emotional indifference. His extreme kindness and decency are thoroughly impersonal and seem to come from another planet." Max Born, another personal and professional friend, noted the same trait, and it seemed to explain Einstein's ability to remain somewhat oblivious to the tribulations afflicting Europe during World War I. For all his kindness, sociability, and love of humanity, he was, nevertheless, totally detached from his environment and the human beings in it. Einstein's personal detachment and scientific creativity seemed to be subtly linked. According to his colleague Abraham Pice, this detachment sprang from Einstein's salient trait of apartness, which led him to reject scientific conventional wisdom as well as emotional intimacies. It is easier to be a nonconformist and rebel, both in science and in a militaristic culture like Germany's, when you can detach yourself easily from others. The detachment enabled him to walk through life immersed in thought, Pais said. It also allowed him, or compelled him, to pursue his theories in both a single-minded and single-handed manner. Einstein understood the conflicting forces in his own soul, and he seemed to think it was true for all people. "Man is, at one and the same time, a solitary being and a social being," he said. His own desire for detachment conflicted with his desire for companionship, mirroring the struggle between his attraction and his aversion to fame. Using the jargon of psychoanalysis, the pioneering therapist Erik Erikson once pronounced of Einstein, "A certain alternation of isolation and outgoingness seems to have retained the character of a dynamic polarization." Einstein's desire for detachment was reflected in his extramarital relationships. As long as women did not make any claims on him, and he felt free to approach them or not according to his own moods, he was able to sustain a romance. But the fear that he might have to surrender some of his independence led him to erect a shield. This was even more evident in his relationship with his family. He was not always merely cold, for there were times, especially when it came to Mileva Maric, that the forces of both attraction and repulsion raged inside him with a fiery heat. His problem, especially with his family, was that he was resistant to such strong feelings in others. "He had no gift for empathy," writes historian Thomas Levinson, no ability to imagine himself into the emotional life of anyone else. When confronted with the emotional needs of others, Einstein tended to retreat into the objectivity of his science. The collapse of the German currency had caused him to urge Marich to move there, since it had become hard for him to afford her cost of living in Switzerland using depreciated German marks. But once the eclipse observations made him famous and more financially secure, he was willing to let his family stay in Zurich. To support them, he had the fees from his European lecture trips sent directly to Ehrenfest in Holland, so that the money would not be converted into Germany's sinking currency. Einstein wrote Ehrenfest cryptic letters referring to his hard currency reserves as results which you and I obtained here on AU ions, i.e. gold. The money was then dispersed by Ehrenfest to Marich and the children. Shortly after his remarriage, Einstein visited Zurich to see his sons. Hans Albert, then 15, announced that he had decided to become an engineer. "I think it's a disgusting idea," said Einstein, whose father and uncle had been engineers. "I'm still going to be an engineer," replied the boy. Einstein stormed away angry, and once again their relationship deteriorated, especially after he received a nasty letter from Hans Albert. "He wrote me as no decent person has ever written their father," he explained in a pained letter to his other son, Eduard. "It's doubtful I'll ever be able to take up a relationship with him again." But Marich by then was intent on improving rather than undermining his relationship with his sons. So she emphasized to the boys that Einstein was a strange man in many ways, but he was still their father and wanted their love. He could be cold, she said, but also good and kind. According to an account provided by Hans Albert, Mileva knew that for all his bluff, Albert could be hurt in personal matters, and hurt deeply. By later that year, Einstein and his older son were again corresponding regularly about everything from politics to science. He also expressed his appreciation to Marich, joking that she should be happier now that she did not have to put up with him. "I plan on coming to Zurich soon, and we should put all the bad things behind us. You should enjoy what life has given you, like the wonderful children, the house, and that you're not married to me anymore." Hans Albert went on to enroll at his parents' alma mater, the Zurich Polytechnic, and became an engineer. He took a job at a steel company, and then as a research assistant at the Polytechnic studying hydraulics and rivers. Especially after he scored first in his exams, his father not only became reconciled, but proud. "My Albert has become a sound, strong chap," Einstein wrote Besso in 1924. "He is a total picture of a man, a first-rate sailor, unpretentious and dependable." Einstein eventually said the same to Hans Albert, adding that he may have been right to become an engineer. "Science is a difficult profession," he wrote. "Sometimes I am glad that you have chosen a practical field, where one does not have to look for a four-leaf clover." One person who elicited strong and sustained personal emotions in Einstein was his mother. Dying from stomach cancer, she had moved in with him and Elsa at the end of 1919, and watching her suffer overwhelmed whatever human detachment he usually felt or feigned. When she died in February 1920, Einstein was exhausted by the emotions. "One feels right into one's bones what ties of blood mean," he wrote Sanger. Katha Freundlich had heard him boast to her husband, the astronomer, that no death would affect him, and she was relieved that his mother's death proved that untrue. "Einstein wept like other men," she said, "and I knew that he could really care for someone." The ripples from relativity. For nearly three centuries, the mechanical universe of Isaac Newton, based on absolute certainties and laws, had formed the psychological foundation of the Enlightenment and the social order, with a belief in causes and effects, order, even duty. Now came a view of the universe known as relativity, in which space and time were dependent on frames of reference. This apparent dismissal of certainties, an abandonment of faith in the absolute, seemed vaguely heretical to some people, perhaps even godless. "It formed a knife," historian Paul Johnson wrote in his sweeping history of the 20th century, Modern Times, "to help cut society adrift from its traditional moorings." The horrors of the Great War, the breakdown of social hierarchies, the advent of relativity and its apparent undermining of classical physics all seem to combine to produce uncertainty. For some years past, the entire world has been in a state of unrest, mental as well as physical, a Columbia University astronomer, Charles Poor, told the New York Times the week after the confirmation of Einstein's theory was announced. It may well be that the physical aspects of the unrest, the war, the strikes, the Bolshevist uprisings, are in reality the visible objects of some underlying deeper disturbance, worldwide in character. This same spirit of unrest has invaded science. Indirectly, driven by popular misunderstandings rather than a fealty to Einstein's thinking, relativity became associated with a new relativism in morality and art and politics. There was less faith in absolutes, not only of time and space, but also of truth and morality. In a December 1919 editorial about Einstein's relativity theory titled "Assaulting the Absolute," the New York Times fretted that the foundations of all human thought have been undermined. Einstein would have been, and later was, appalled at the conflation of relativity with relativism. As noted, he had considered calling his theory invariance, because the physical laws of combined space-time, according to his theory, were indeed invariant rather than relative. Moreover, he was not a relativist in his own morality or even in his taste. The word relativity has been widely misinterpreted as relativism, the denial of or doubt about the objectivity of truth or moral values, the philosopher Isaiah Berlin later lamented. This was the opposite of what Einstein believed. He was a man of simple and absolute moral convictions, which were expressed in all he was and did. In both his science and his moral philosophy, Einstein was driven by a quest for certainty and deterministic laws. If his theory of relativity produced ripples that unsettled the realms of morality and culture, this was caused not by what Einstein believed, but by how he was popularly interpreted. One of those popular interpreters, for example, was the British statesman Lord Haldane, who fancied himself a philosopher and scientific scholar. In 1921, he published a book called The Reign of Relativity, which enlisted Einstein's theory to support his own political views on the need to avoid dogmatism in order to have a dynamic society. Einstein's principle of the relativity of our measurements of space and time cannot be taken in isolation, he wrote. When its import is considered, it may well be found to have its counterpart in other domains of nature and of knowledge generally. Relativity theory would have profound consequences for theology, Haldane warned the Archbishop of Canterbury, who immediately tried to comprehend the theory with only modest success. The Archbishop, one minister reported to the Dean of English Science, J.J. Thompson, can make neither head nor tail of Einstein, and protests that the more he listens to Haldane and the more newspaper articles he reads on the subject, the less he understands. Haldane persuaded Einstein to come to England in 1921. He and Elsa stayed at Haldane's grand London townhouse, where they found themselves completely intimidated by their assigned footman and butler. The dinner that Haldane hosted in Einstein's honor convened a pride of English intellectuals leonine enough to awe an Oxford senior common room. Among those present were George Bernard Shaw, Arthur Eddington, J.J. Thompson, Harold Vlaski, and, of course, the baffled Archbishop of Canterbury, who got a personal briefing from Thompson in preparation. Haldane seated the Archbishop next to Einstein, so he got to pose his burning question directly to the source. What ramifications, His Grace inquired, did the theory of relativity have for religion? The answer probably disappointed both the Archbishop and their host. None, Einstein said. Relativity is purely a scientific matter and has nothing to do with religion. That was no doubt true. However, there was a more complex relationship between Einstein's theories and the whole witch's brew of ideas and emotions in the early 20th century that bubbled up from the highly charged cauldron of modernism. In his novel Balthazar, Lawrence Durrell had his character declare, "The relativity proposition was directly responsible for abstract painting, atonal music, and formless literature." The relativity proposition, of course, was not directly responsible for any of this. Instead, its relationship with modernism was more mysteriously interactive. There are historical moments when an alignment of forces causes a shift in human outlook. It happened to art and philosophy and science at the beginning of the Renaissance, and again at the beginning of the Enlightenment. Now, in the early 20th century, modernism was born by the breaking of the old strictures and verities. A spontaneous combustion occurred that included the works of Einstein, Picasso, Matisse, Stravinsky, Schoenberg, Joyce, Eliot, Proust, Diaghilev, Freud, Wittgenstein, and dozens of other pathbreakers who seemed to break the bonds of classical thinking. In his book Einstein, Picasso, Space, Time, and the Beauty That Causes Havoc, the historian of science and philosophy, Arthur I. Miller, explored the common wellsprings that produced, for example, the 1905 Special Theory of Relativity and Picasso's 1907 modernist masterpiece, Les Demoiselles d'Avignon. Miller noted that both were men of great charm, yet who preferred emotional detachment. Each, in his own way, felt that something was amiss in the strictures that defined his field, and they were both intrigued by discussions of simultaneity, space, time, and specifically the writings of Poincaré. Einstein served as a source of inspiration for many of the modernist artists and thinkers, even when they did not understand him. This was especially true when artists celebrated such concepts as being free from the order of time, as Proust put it in the closing of Remembrance of Things Past. "How I would love to speak to you about Einstein," Proust wrote to a physicist friend in 1921. "I do not understand a single word of his theories, not knowing algebra. Nevertheless, it seems we have analogous ways of deforming time." A pinnacle of the modernist revolution came in 1922, the year Einstein's Nobel Prize was announced. James Joyce's Ulysses was published that year, as was T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. There was a midnight dinner party in May at the Majestic Hotel in Paris for the opening of Renard, composed by Stravinsky and performed by Diaghilev's Ballet Russe. Stravinsky and Diaghilev were both there, as was Picasso. So, too, were both Joyce and Proust, who were destroying 19th-century literary certainties as surely as Einstein was revolutionizing physics. The mechanical order and Newtonian laws that had defined classical physics, music, and art no longer ruled. Whatever the causes of the new relativism and modernism, the untethering of the world from its classical moorings would soon produce some unnerving reverberations and reactions. And nowhere was that mood more troubling than in Germany in the 1920s. Chapter 13. The Wandering Zionist, 1920 to 1921. Kinship. In the article he wrote for the Times of London after the confirmation of his relativity theory, Einstein quipped that if things went bad, the Germans would no longer consider him a compatriot, but instead a Swiss Jew. It was a clever remark, made more so because Einstein knew even then that there was an odious smell of truth to it. That very week, in a letter to his friend Paul Ehrenfest, he described the mood in Germany. "Anti-Semitism is very strong here," he wrote. "Where is all this supposed to lead?" The rise of German anti-Semitism after World War I produced a counter-reaction in Einstein. It made him identify more strongly with his Jewish heritage and community. At one extreme were German Jews such as Fritz Haber, who did everything they could, including converting to Christianity, to assimilate, and they urged Einstein to do the same. But Einstein took the opposite approach. Just when he was becoming famous, he embraced the Zionist cause. He did not officially join any Zionist organization, nor, for that matter, did he belong to or worship at any synagogue. But he cast his lot in favor of Jewish settlements in Palestine, a national identity among Jews everywhere, and the rejection of assimilationist desires. He was recruited by the pioneering Zionist leader Kurt Blumenfeld, who paid a call on Einstein in Berlin in early 1919. "With extreme naivete, he asked questions," Blumenfeld recalled. Among Einstein's queries, "With their spiritual and intellectual gifts, why should Jews be called on to create an agricultural nation-state?" Wasn't nationalism the problem rather than the solution? Eventually, Einstein came around to the cause. "I am, as a human being, an opponent of nationalism," he declared. "But as a Jew, I am from today a supporter of the Zionist effort." He also became, more specifically, an advocate for the creation of a new Jewish university in Palestine, which eventually became Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Once he decided to abandon the postulate that all forms of nationalism were bad, he found it easy to embrace Zionism with greater enthusiasm. "One can be an internationalist without being indifferent to members of one's tribe," he wrote a friend in October 1919. "The Zionist cause is very close to my heart. I am glad that there should be a little patch of earth on which our kindred brethren are not considered aliens." His support for Zionism put Einstein at odds with assimilationists. In April 1920, he was invited to address a meeting of one such group that emphasized its members' loyalty to Germany, the German citizens of the Jewish faith. He replied by accusing them of trying to separate themselves from the poorer and less polished Eastern European Jews. "Can the Aryan respect such pussyfooters?" he chided. Privately declining the invitation was not enough. Einstein also felt compelled to write a public attack on those who tried to fit in by talking about religious faith instead of tribal affiliation. The word he used was Stammesgenossen. Although Stamm generally means tribe, the translation can have some racial overtones. Some Einstein scholars have said that translations such as kindred or clan or lineage might be clearer. In particular, he scorned what he called the assimilatory approach that sought to overcome anti-Semitism by dropping nearly everything Jewish. This never worked. Indeed, it appears somewhat comical to a non-Jew, because the Jews are a people set apart from others. The psychological root of anti-Semitism lies in the fact that the Jews are a group of people unto themselves, he wrote. Their Jewishness is visible in their physical appearance, and one notices their Jewish heritage in their intellectual work. The Jews who practiced and preached assimilation tended to be those who took pride in their German or Western European heritage. At the time, and through much of the 20th century, they tended to look down on Jews from Eastern Europe, such as Russia and Poland, who seemed less polished, refined, and assimilated. Although Einstein was German-Jewish, he was appalled by those from his background who would draw a sharp dividing line between Eastern European Jews and Western European Jews. The approach was doomed to backfire against all Jews, he argued, and it was not based on any true distinction. Eastern European Jewry contains a rich potential of human talents and productive forces that can well stand the comparison to the higher civilization of Western European Jews. Einstein was acutely aware, even more than the assimilationists, that anti-Semitism was not the result of rational causes. "In Germany today, hatred of the Jews has taken on horrible expressions," he wrote in early 1920. Part of the problem was that inflation was out of control. The German mark had been worth about 12 cents at the beginning of 1919, which was half of its value from before the war, but still manageable. But by the beginning of 1920, the mark was worth a mere 2 cents and collapsing further each month. In addition, the loss of the war had been humiliating. Germany had lost 6 million men and then was forced into surrendering land containing half of its natural resources, plus all of its overseas colonies. Many proud Germans believed it must have been the result of betrayal. The Weimar Republic that had emerged after the war, though supported by liberals and pacifists and Jews such as Einstein, was disdained by much of the old order and even the middle class. There was one group that could easily be cast as the alien and dark force most responsible for the humiliation facing a proud culture. "People need a scapegoat and make the Jews responsible," Einstein noted. "They are a target of instinctive resentment because they are of a different tribe." Weiland, Lennart, and the Anti-Relativists. The explosion of great art and ideas in Germany at the time, as Amos Elon wrote in his book The Pity of It All, was largely due to Jewish patrons and pioneers in a variety of fields. This was particularly true in science. As Sigmund Freud pointed out, part of the success of Jewish scientists was their creative skepticism, which arose from their essential nature as outsiders. What the Jewish assimilationists underestimated was the virulence with which many Germans, whom they considered to be their fellow countrymen, in fact saw them as essentially outsiders, or, as Einstein put it, a different tribe. Einstein's first public collision with this anti-Semitism came in the summer of 1920. A shady German nationalist named Paul Weiland, an engineer by training, had turned himself into a polemicist with political aspirations. He was an active member of a right-wing nationalistic political party that pledged, in its 1920 official program, to diminish the dominant Jewish influence showing up increasingly in government and in public. Weiland realized that Einstein, as a highly publicized Jew, had engendered resentment and jealousy. Likewise, his relativity theory was easy to turn into a target, because many people, including some scientists, were unnerved by the way it seemed to undermine absolutes and be built on abstract hypotheses rather than grounded in solid experiment. So, Weiland published articles denouncing relativity as a big hoax, and formed a ragtag but mysteriously well-funded organization, grandly dubbed the Study Group of German Scientists for the Preservation of a Pure Science. Joining with Weiland was an experimental physicist of modest reputation named Ernst Gercke, who for years had been assailing relativity with more vehemence than comprehension. Their group lobbed a few personal attacks at Einstein and the Jewish nature of relativity theory, then called a series of meetings around Germany, including a large rally in Berlin's Philharmonic Hall on August 24th. Weiland spoke first, and with the orotund rhetoric of a demagogue, accused Einstein of engaging in a business-like booming of his theory and his name. Einstein's penchant for publicity, wanted or not, was being used against him, as his assimilationist friends had warned. Relativity was a hoax, Weiland said, and plagiarized to boot. Gercke said much the same thing with a more technical gloss, reading from a written text. The meeting, reported the New York Times, had a decidedly anti-Semitic complexion. In the middle of Gercke's talk, there arose from the audience a quiet murmur. Einstein, Einstein. He had come to see the circus, and, averse neither to publicity nor controversy, laugh at the spectacle. As his friend Philip Frank noted, he always liked to regard events in the world around him as if he were a spectator in a theater. Sitting in the audience with his friend and chemist, Walter Nernst, he cackled loudly at times, and at the end pronounced the entire event most amusing. But he was not truly amused, and he even briefly considered moving away from Berlin. His anger aroused, he made the tactical mistake of responding with a highly charged diatribe that was published 3 days later on the front page of the Berliner Tageblatt, a liberal daily owned by Jewish friends. "I am well aware that the two speakers are unworthy of reply by my pen," he said, but then proceeded not to be restrained by that awareness. Gercke and Weiland had not been explicitly anti-Semitic, nor did they overtly criticize Jews in their speeches. But Einstein alleged that they would not have attacked his theory if I were a German nationalist, with or without a swastika, instead of a Jew. Einstein spent most of his piece refuting Weiland and Gercke, but he also attacked a more reputable physicist who was not at the meeting but had given support to the anti-relativity cause, Philipp Lennert. Winner of the 1905 Nobel Prize, Lennert had been a pioneer experimenter who described the photoelectric effect. Einstein had once admired him. "I have just read a wonderful paper by Lennert," Einstein had gushed to Maric back in 1901. "Under this beautiful piece, I am filled with such happiness and joy that I absolutely must share some of it with you." After Einstein had published his first spate of seminal papers in 1905, citing Lennert by name in the one on light quanta, the two scientists had exchanged flattering letters. But as an ardent German nationalist, Lennert had become increasingly bitter about the British and the Jews, contemptuous of the publicity Einstein's theory was garnering, and vocal in his attacks on the absurd aspects of relativity. He had allowed his name to be used on brochures that were distributed at Weiland's meeting, and as a Nobel laureate, he had worked behind the scenes to make sure that Einstein was not awarded the prize. Because Lennert had refrained from showing up at the Philharmonic Hall rally, and because his published critiques of relativity had been academic in tone, Einstein did not need to attack him in his newspaper piece, but he did. I admire Leonard as a master of experimental physics, but he has not yet produced anything outstanding in theoretical physics, and his objections to the general theory of relativity are of such superficiality that, up until now, I did not think it necessary to answer them, he wrote. I intend to make up for this. Einstein's friends publicly supported him. A group that included von Laue and Nernst published a letter claiming, not altogether accurately, whoever is fortunate enough to be close to Einstein knows that he will never be surpassed in his dislike of all publicity. Privately, however, his friends were appalled. He had been provoked into a display of public anger against those who should have remained unworthy of a reply by his pen, thus stirring up even more distasteful publicity. Max Born's wife Hedwig, who had freely scolded Einstein about his treatment of his family, now lectured, "You should not have allowed yourself to be goaded into that rather unfortunate reply. He should show more respect," she said, "for the secluded temple of science." Paul Ehrenfest was even harsher. "My wife and I absolutely cannot believe that you yourself wrote some of the phrases in the article," he said. "If you really did write them down with your own hand, it proves that these damned pigs have finally succeeded in touching your soul. I urge you, as strongly as I can, not to throw one more word on this subject to that voracious beast, the public." Einstein was somewhat controlled.